research, but he said that the protecting the planet is a moral and ethical imperative for believers and non-believers alike. The importance of his addressing people of other faiths as well in that encyclical.
Absolutely. He addressed that encyclical, as you said, to all people of the world. And one thing that is evident in the encyclical as well and in his other writings is the way in which he's listening to people of the world, not just Catholics. So he's quoting people in the encyclical who are not just Catholic leaders, but recognizing that the Catholic social teaching can learn from everybody, and that he wanted to enter into a dialogue with people of the world. And in some respects, that message was heard better outside of the Catholic Church than inside. There are still many contexts where Catholics are resisting this call to ecological conversion and to an integral ecology, as he put it, where Catholics are caught up in the very patterns of environmental destruction and social injustice that he was calling out. And I think he knew that this is a challenge and a task that would require more than just, you know, the flock that he shepherds. And again, I think that's a very Christian thing to do. You know, Jesus in his ministry often went to the peripheries, reached outside of the Jewish people, spoke to people and learned from people and held up people who were not part of his particular social group. And that's something that I think Francis is echoing in turning to a dialogue with the world, recognizing that that in some respects his own people are part of the problem.
Very quickly, 30 seconds, the successors who are being talked about, you know, the conclave will decide. You've got two front runners from the Philippines, among them Luis Antonio Tego, Pietro Parolin of Italy, Peter Turks in Ghana, front runner from Hungary, and another from Italy. Your thoughts on where this goes?
You know, it's a complex process, and I don't claim any special insight in it. But I do think this is a really critical moment for moral leadership in the world at a time where we are tempted to put up more walls among our people and among countries, that the selection of this next pope will be, you know, could be a turning point in deciding whether we as a, you know, as a species turn toward solidarity or build our walls even higher.
Nathan Schneider, we thank you so much for being with us, professor of media studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. We'll link to your articles in America Magazine, National Catholic Magazine, published by the Jesuits. Long been covering Catholic engagement with climate change and the economy, co-editor of the book Beautiful Solutions, A Toolbox for Liberation. Next up, we speak with a lawyer for Rumeysa Öztürk, the Tufts doctoral student who is abducted by masked federal agents and ultimately sent to Louisiana. Judges ordered her to be transferred to Vermont. Stay with us. Onyebar. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A federal judge has ordered the Turkish national Tufts University PhD student Rumeysa Öztürk to be transferred to Vermont no later than May 1st as she seeks to challenge what her lawyers call her unconstitutional detention in an ICE jail in Louisiana. That order came Friday and followed a separate hearing last Wednesday when an immigration judge denied bond for Rumeysa, declaring her to be a potential so-called danger to the community. Rumeysa, who is from Turkey, was arrested for co-authoring a student op-ed on Tufts' response to Gaza solidarity protests on campus. Rumeysa Öztürk is a doctoral candidate in the school's Department of Child Study and Human Development and research assistant at Tufts Children's Television Project. She's a former Fulbright scholar. On March 25th, masked, plainclothes immigration agents snatched her from the streets of Somerville, Massachusetts, outside Tufts. Surveillance video from a nearby house shows agents approaching her on the streets near her home. In the video, you can hear her scream as the agents move to detain her. Apparently, she said something like, "I'm calling the police," and they said something like, "They are the police." The Washington Post reports the State Department found no evidence linking Rumeysa Öztürk to anti-Semitic activities or public statements in support of terrorism. The Washington Post reports a State Department memo determined Secretary of State Marco Rubio did not have sufficient grounds for revoking her visa, contradicting public accusations made by the Trump administration. Meanwhile, the Tufts University Democrats and Republicans have released a joint statement condemning the Trump administration's arrest and detention of Rumeysa and its overall attack on international students and their right to free speech. As she awaits transfer to Vermont, Rumeysa's jailed at a privately run ICE jail in Louisiana. For more, we're joined by one of Rumeysa's attorneys, Madas Ortapa, staff attorney at CLEAR, a legal nonprofit clinic at CUNY School of Law. Madas, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you explain exactly what happened? This is all also happening as another judge ruled that something like 130 international students have to have their visas reinstated.
Yes. Thank you, Amy, for having me. So there's two parallel tracks in Ms. Öztürk's case. There's the immigration proceedings that you mentioned that involved this bond proceeding that happened last Wednesday, where the immigration judge found that based on this one paragraph memo from the State Department that says that you know, the only evidence that's cited is this op-ed that she co-authored that references a common cause with an organization that was later temporarily banned from campus, as supporting a finding that she was a danger to her community or a flight risk. And so those proceedings are happening on a parallel track to the habeas proceedings that are happening in federal court. And Ms. Öztürk's initial petition was filed in the District Court of Massachusetts. That was eventually transferred to the District of Vermont because at the time that petition was filed, that's where she was. The court heard arguments on the government's motion to dismiss and our motion for bail and for Ms. Öztürk's release. And this last Friday, the court rejected the government's arguments and held that it did have jurisdiction to hear her claims. And so Ms. Öztürk's transfer has now been ordered. She's been ordered to be transferred back to Vermont. And the court has also ordered a bail hearing to happen on May 9th and a hearing to hear the underlying merits of her habeas petition on May 22nd. And this is important, at least with respect to cases involving, you know, ideological retaliation against students for their advocacy for Palestinian human rights. This is the first federal court that's actually said it has jurisdiction to hear these claims and is moving on to that phase of the process. And with respect to, you know, the temporary restraining orders that have been handed down in other courts regarding visa revocations writ large, Those are happening not just in Georgia, but throughout the country. As far as I'm aware, I think there have been at least six TROs issued, and some of those have extended beyond just the individual plaintiffs in those cases.
And I wanted to ask you, this whole issue of her student visa being revoked on March 21st without even her knowledge, could you talk about that and the implications of that for other international students?
Yeah, it's really chilling, you know. So the same memo that the government submits in Ms. Ozturk's removal case, this one paragraph memo from the State Department, it has this underlined portion, and this is underlined by the government itself, that says, due to ongoing ICE operational security, this revocation will be silent. And this is completely abnormal. The government is normally going to notify students that there's been a revocation. Generally, revocations will take place because of, you know, some issues regarding, like, the student perhaps not maintaining a full course load, or a criminal offense that renders them unable to maintain their student status. So typically, students are given notice, and they're given the opportunity to pursue other avenues of relief, potentially, you know, seeking a different type of visa or self-deportation, or, you know, just leaving the country. In this case, the government was clear it was intending to abduct Ms. Ozturk. They didn't want her to know that her visa was revoked. And 4 days later, they did exactly what they planned and abducted her in broad daylight in a street on Massachusetts.
And could you talk about the role of a Canary Mission and others like it in essentially identifying for the government people that they should be deporting?
Yeah. And, you know, I think at this point, there's been a clear connection that we can draw, right, from the doxing organizations, the pro-Israeli doxing organizations. And there is a clear doxing to deportation pipeline that's taking place. And in Ms. Ozturk's case, it's even more apparent, because Ms. Ozturk was not a known organizer or advocate for any cause, really. Ms. Ozturk's sole sort of publicly identifiable association to, you know, the movement against the genocide and the movement for Palestinian human rights was this co-authored op-ed in her school newspaper that was really just asking the university to respect the wishes and the vote of the student senate. You know, all of a sudden, in February of 2025, almost a year after she's co-written this op-ed, Canary Mission publishes a page on her, doxing her and alleging that she's engaged in anti-Semitic behavior because of this co-authored op-ed. And less than a month later, she's abducted by ICE. And so it's very chilling that, you know, the government seems to be taking their marching orders from these private, you know, doxing organizations with mysterious funding and backing. And I think it underscores why the government's actions are you know, simply unconscionable.
Well, we'll continue to cover Ramesses' case, see if they will send her back to Vermont, where the masked agents drove her to before sending her to Louisiana. Badasser Tapa, thanks so much for being with us. One of the attorneys for Ramesses Ozturk, a staff attorney at CLEAR, a legal clinic at CUNY School of Law. Again, the Democrats and Republicans at Tufts sent a joint letter objecting to her treatment, as did Tufts University. Next up, 70 years ago this week, the historic anti-colonial Bandung Conference took place. We'll speak to Vijay Prashad in Chile. Stay with us.
We're in the same boat, brother. We're in the same boat, brother. And if you shake one end, you're gonna rock the other. It's the same boat, brother.
Lordy looked down from his holy place, said, Lordy me, what a sea of space. What's about to launch the human race? So he built him a boat for a mixed up crew, with eyes of black and brown and blue. So that's how come that you and I got just one world with just one sky.
We're in the same
the Same Boat, Brother by Lead Belly. And speaking of music, on Friday, we'll be bringing you an extended interview with the great director Ryan Coogler, his new film just out, Sinners. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As President Trump moves to upend the global trade system, we look back at a critical moment 70 years ago when 29 nations from Asia and Africa gathered in Bandung, Indonesia, for a historic anti-colonial conference. The 1955 Bandung Conference marked a critical moment that the peoples of colonial nations of the global south made their collective presence felt on the world stage. It marked the birth of what would later become the non-aligned movement in the midst of the Cold War. Key nations participating included India, China, Indonesia, Egypt, Burma, Pakistan, Vietnam, and Ceylon, now known as Sri Lanka. This is the Indonesian president at the time, Sukarno, speaking at Bandung.
This is the first intercontinental conference of colored peoples, so-called colored peoples, in the history of mankind. I am proud that my country is your host. It is a new departure in the history of the world that leaders of Asian and African peoples can meet together in their own countries to discuss and deliberate upon matters of common concern.
Malcolm X would later talk about the historic importance of the Bandung Conference.
At Bandung, all the nations came together. They were dark nations from Africa and Asia. Some of them were Buddhists. Some of them were Muslim. Some of them were Christian. Some of them were Confucianists. Some were atheists. Despite their religious differences, they came together. Some were communists, some were socialists, some were capitalists. Despite their economic and political differences, they came together. All of them were black, brown, red, or yellow. The number one thing that was not allowed to attend the Bandung Conference was the white man. He couldn't come. Once they excluded the white man, they found that they could get together. Once they kept him out, everybody else fell right in and fell in line. This is the thing that you and I have to understand. And these people who came together didn't have nuclear weapons. They didn't have jet planes. They didn't have all of the heavy armaments that the white man has. But they had unity.
Malcolm X, the 100th anniversary of his birth, will be in May. We're joined now by Vijay Prashad, the director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. His latest newsletter is titled Waiting for a New Bandung Spirit. Vijay Prashad has written more than 40 books, including The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, which was just published in Indonesia this week. His latest piece for Globetrotter is on BRICS and industrial development. He's joining us from Santiago, Chile. Vijay, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's go back 70 years. Talk about the significance of the Bandung Conference, how it came together, and what this meant for the world today.
You know, it's very interesting, Amy, that right after World War II, there was an enormous upsurge of political unrest in the former colonies in Asia and Africa. This unrest led by anti-colonial movements was taking place not only for freedom in their countries, but for freedom in each other's countries. So in India, even before India won its independence in August of 1947, they convened a conference called the Asian Relations Conference, which was for solidarity with the people of Indonesia fighting against the Dutch. That was the spirit of the age. Hundreds of millions of people across Africa, across Asia, fighting against colonialism, fighting brutal colonial wars in Malaya, in Kenya, the so-called Mau Mau Rebellion. At this moment, They gathered in Bandung, Indonesia, beautiful city in Indonesia, under the leadership of President Sukarno, who had won a really courageous fight, first against Japanese imperialism and then the Dutch. They came together. And what's really remarkable is, as Malcolm X says, they came, communists like Chou En-lai came few years after the Chinese Revolution, but also Sir John Kotalawala of Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, a absolute anti-communist. I mean, they all gathered together because they understood that their unity was very important, not only to create a new trade and development order. That was not the only part, but also to fight for peace, because they understood what it meant to live on the other side of a rifle. They understood that if the Cold War was allowed to metastasize, it would just not allow them to develop. So the watchwords from Bandung were peace and development. And these people who came there, Nehru, Nasser, Sukarno, Chou En-lai, they represented vast movements from around the world. They were not afraid of the people. They walked from their hotel to the conference venue. There were no armed guards. They met the people. They were greeted with cheers. And they gave powerful speeches, not only of unity, as Malcolm X points out, but also to say that, look, we don't have nuclear weapons, but we have the moral force of the anti-colonial movement. And that's what we're putting before the world. We want to change the world, make it a better place. We don't want the force of guns to rule over us any longer.
And Vijay, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned some of the leaders who were there, but interestingly, many of those leaders within a few years were either overthrown, for instance, Sukarno in 1965, Nkrumah, and Nasser, and even on the way to the conference, there was an assassination attempt against Chou En-lai. The plane that he was scheduled to take to the conference was bombed and out of the air. And luckily, Chou En-lai supposedly had to postpone taking that plane because of an illness. But could you talk about how much the Western powers were in fear of what was developing as a result of Bandung?
It's very important to know that when you read the U.S. government documents, John Foster Dulles and others were quite furious with what was happening at Bandung. They refused to call this a non-aligned process. They insisted on calling them neutralists, saying that these people are in fact pro-communist, completely mischaracterizing the difference of political opinion at Bandung. And this attack at Bandung, really takes on a vicious form when it comes to the coups in the early to mid 1960s. It's important for people to remember that there was a trinity of coup d'etats in the 1960s against progressive governments in the largest countries in Africa, South America, and in Asia. First, the coup against Patrice Lumumba. Lumumba was, in a very real sense, the descendant of Nkrumahism, of the belief in Pan-Africanism of Kwame Nkrumah, comes to power in the largest country in Africa, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, is overthrown in a brutal coup led by the United States, the Belgians, the British intelligence services, and so on. That's in 1961. It destabilizes the national liberation movement in Africa, followed 3 years later by a coup d'etat against the liberal president, elected president of Brazil, Juan Goulart, in 1964, a coup that lasts 21 years, where the military in Brazil is then authorized through Operation Condor to effectively utilize military services across Latin America to cut down the impact of the Cuban Revolution of 1959. And that's the a process that leads to the coup in Chile in 73, in Argentina in 76, and so on. Again, the largest country in Latin America, a coup pushed by the United States. And finally, 10 years after Bandung, as you rightly said, the coup d'etat against Sukarno, a million communists killed, often with faxes, telexes sent by the Australian intelligence services, British and United States, names of people that they wanted the military in Indonesia to execute, a million people killed, the progressive government of Sukarno overthrown. This has a huge impact in Asia. Bandung represented hope for the hundreds of millions of people around the planet in 1955. It was to crush that hope that the United States and its allies conducted these coups against Lumumba, Gulat, and then Sukarno.
And what is your sense, you've written now, in terms of the spirit of Bandung and what the situation is for the countries of the global south? Now, you talked also about BRICS quite a bit in the last few years.
I mean, you know, it's interesting, Juan, because at the time of Bandung, the subjective or the consciousness of the need for a new change, for unity, for this moral force called the Third World, this was extremely high. But this sense, this consciousness of the need for change was far greater than the ability of these states. You know, these states were outclassed when it came to military power. These states simply didn't have the kind of wealth, technological capacity. In fact, they couldn't produce most things by themselves. You know, Walter Rodney will write later in How Europe Underdeveloped Africa that most African countries at the time of their independence were not able to produce toothpaste because they had to import it from Lever Brothers, from a British multinational corporation. These countries were at an objective disadvantage. Well, you know, the debt crisis of the 1980s really collapsed the political unities, the hope from the Third World. But something new has emerged, particularly since the world financial crisis of 2007-2008. The large countries of the South, particularly in Asia, led by China, have developed their manufacturing, they've developed their technological capacity. In terms of the objective changes taking place, we can see that before our eyes. The center of gravity of the world economy is no longer the Atlantic Ocean. It's definitely now in Asia, somewhere between China, Vietnam, Bangladesh, India, Indonesia. These countries are growing at a very fast clip. But the sense of political unity is still not fully visible, despite the BRICS. The BRICS is a trade body. It's not really a political body. It shouldn't be exaggerated. So that sense of Bandung, which was there in 1955, is not there now. We're sort of waiting on the revival of the Bandung spirit. We've got the structures for a new world relatively in place, but we don't really have the consciousness, the confidence that a new world can be built. And by the way,
we have
the
10
consciousness
seconds,
in the North is not there either.
We have 10 seconds.
Yeah, I'm just saying the consciousness in the northern countries not there either as of yet. Trump's tariffs trying to reverse this trend, not going to work.
We have to leave it there. Vijay Prashad, Director of Tricontinental. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Please enjoy 30 Seconds of Nature, brought to you by Ducks Unlimited Canada. Learn how you can experience nature in your community at ducks.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.